Chapter 43. Ordering the true sentiments of loyalty, which consists in reverencing these and other articles of costume. And this fifth act, then, of his long royal drama, old Louis performed his part excellently, and when the curtain drops upon him, he lies, dressed majestically, in a becoming kingly attitude, as a king should. The king his successor has not left, at Versailles, half so much occasion for moralizing. Perhaps the neighboring park ox serfs would afford better illustrations of his reign. The life of his great-grandsire, the Grand Lama of France, seems to have frightened Louis the Well-Beloved, who understood that loneliness is one of the necessary conditions of divinity, and being of a jovial, companionable turn, aspired not beyond manhood. Only in the matter of ladies did he surpass his predecessor, as Solomon did David. War he eschewed, as his grandfather bade him, and his simple taste found little in this world to enjoy beyond the mulling of chocolate and the frying of pancakes. Look, here is the room called Laborator du Roy, where, with his own hands, he made his mistress's breakfast. Here is the little door through which, from her apartments, in the upper story, the chaste du Barry came stealing down to the arms of the weary, feeble, gloomy old man. But of women he was tired long since, and even pancake frying had palled upon him. What had he to do, after 40 years of reign, after having exhausted everything? Every pleasure that Dubois could invent for his hot youth, or cunning Lebel could minister to his old age, was flat and stale, used up to the very dregs. Every shilling in the national purse had been squeezed out, by Pompadour and du Barry, and such brilliant ministers of state. He had found out the vanity of pleasure, as his ancestor had discovered the vanity of glory. Indeed it was high time that he should die. And die he did. And round his tomb, as round that of his grandfather before him, the starving people sang a dreadful chorus of curses, which were the only epitaphs for good or for evil, that were raised to his memory. As for the courtiers, the knights and nobles, the unbought grace of life, they, of course, forgot him in 1 minute after his death, as the way is. When the king dies, the officer appointed opens his chamber window, and calling out into the court below, "Le roi est mort," breaks his cane, takes another and waves it, exclaiming, "Vive le roi!" Straightway all the loyal nobles begin yelling "Vive le roi!" And the officer goes round solemnly, and sets yonder great clock in the Tower de Marbre to the hour of the king's death. This old Louis had solemnly ordained. But the Versailles clock was only set twice. There was no shouting of "Vive le roi," when the successor of Louis XV mounted to heaven to join his sainted family. Strange stories of the deaths of kings have always been very recreating and profitable to us. What a fine one is that of the death of Louis XV, as Madame Campan tells it. One night the gracious monarch came back ill from Trianon. The disease turned out to be the smallpox, so violent that 10 people of those who had to enter his chamber caught the infection and died. The whole court flies from him, only poor old fat Mesdames, the king's daughters, persist in remaining at his bedside, and praying for his soul's welfare. On the 10th May, 1774, the whole court had assembled at the chateau. The Aile de Beauf was full. The Dauphin had determined to depart, as soon as the king had breathed his last. And it was agreed by the people of the stables, with those who watched in the king's room, that a lighted candle should be placed in a window, and should be extinguished, as soon as he had ceased to live. The candle was put out. At that signal, guards, pages, and squires mounted on horseback, and everything was made ready for departure. The Dauphin was with the Dauphess, waiting together for the news of the king's demise. An immense noise, as if of thunder, was heard in the next room. It was the crowd of courtiers, who were deserting the dead king's apartment, in order to pay their court to the new power of Louis XVI. Madame de Noailles entered, and was the first, to salute the queen by her title of Queen of France, and begged their majesties to quit their apartments, to receive the princes and great lords of the court desirous to pay their homage to the new sovereigns. leaning on her husband's arm, a handkerchief to her eyes, and the most touching attitude, Marie Antoine received these first visits. On quitting the chamber where the dead king lay, the Duc de Villequier bade M. Anderville, first surgeon of the king, to open and embalm the body. It would have been certain death to the surgeon. "I'm ready, sir," said he, "but whilst I am operating, you must hold the head of the corpse. Your charge demands it." The Duke went away without a word, and the body was neither opened nor embalmed. A few humble domestics and poor workmen watched by the remains, and performed the last offices to their master. The surgeons ordered spirits of wine to be poured into the coffin. They huddled the king's body into a postchaise, and in this deplorable equipage, with an escort of about 40 men, Louis the Well-Beloved was carried, in the dead of night, from Versailles to St. Denis, and then thrown into the tomb of the kings of France. If any man is curious, and can get permission, he may mount to the roof of the palace, and see where Louis XVI used royally to amuse himself, by gazing upon the doings of all the townspeople below with a telescope. Behold that balcony, where, one morning, he, his queen, and the little Dauphin stood, with Cromwell Grandison Lafayette by their side, who kissed Her Majesty's hand, and protected her, and then, lovingly surrounded by his people, the king got into a coach, and came to Paris. Nor did His Majesty ride much in coaches after that. There is a portrait of the king, in the upper galleries, clothed in red and gold, riding a fat horse, brandishing a sword, on which the word Estes is inscribed, and looking remarkably stupid and uncomfortable. You see that the horse will throw him at the very first fling, and as for the sword, it never was made for such hands as his, which were good at holding a corkscrew or a carving knife, but not clever at the management of weapons of war. Let those pity him who will. Call him saint and martyr if you please, but a martyr to what principle was he? Did he frankly support either party in his kingdom, or cheat and tamper with both? He might have escaped, but he must have his supper. And so his family was butchered, and his kingdom lost, and he had his bottle of Burgundy in comfort at Varennes. A single charge upon the fatal 10th of August, and the monarchy might have been his once more. But he is so tender-hearted, that he lets his friends be murdered before his eyes almost. Or, at least, when he has turned his back upon his duty and his kingdom, and has skulked for safety into the reporter's box, at the National Assembly. There were hundreds of brave men who died that day, and were martyrs, if you will, poor neglected 10th-rate courtiers, for the most part, who had forgotten old slights and disappointments, and left their places of safety to come and die, if need were, sharing in the supreme hour of the monarchy. Monarchy was a great deal too humane to fight along with these, and so left them to the pikes of Santer, and the mercy of the men of the sections. But we are wandering a good 10 miles from Versailles, and from the deeds which Louis XVI performed there. He is said to have been such a smart journeyman blacksmith, that he might, if fate had not perversely placed a crown on his head, have earned a couple of louis every week by the making of locks and keys. Those who will, may see the workshop, where he employed many useful hours. Madame Elizabeth was at prayers meanwhile. The queen was making pleasant parties with her ladies. Monsieur the Count d'Artois was learning to dance on the tight rope. And Monsieur de Provence was cultivating l'eloquence du billet and studying his favorite horse. It is said that each member of the August family succeeded remarkably well in his or her pursuits. Big Monsieur's little notes are still cited. At a minuet or syllabub, poor Antoine was unrivaled, and Charles, on the tight rope, was so graceful and so gentle that Madame Sakouai might envy him. The time only was out of joint. Oh, cursed spite, that ever such harmless creatures as these were bidden to write it. A walk to the little Trianon is both pleasing and moral. No doubt the reader has seen the pretty fantastical gardens which environ it, the groves and temples, the streams and caverns, whither, as the guide tells you, during the heat of summer, it was the custom of Marie Antoine to retire, with her favorite, Madame de Lamballe. Colon, the lake and Swiss village are pretty little toys, moreover, and the Cicerone of the place does not fail to point out the different cottages which surround the piece of water, and tell the names of the royal masqueraders who inhabited each. In the long cottage, close upon the lake, dwelt the Seigneur du village, no less a personage than Louis XV, Louis XVI. The Dauphin was the bailey. Near his cottage is that of Monseigneur the Count d'Artois, who was the miller. Opposite lived the Prince de Conde, who enacted the part of gamekeeper, or, indeed, any other role, for it does not signify much. Near him was the Prince de Rohan, who was the almoner. And yonder is the pretty little dairy, which was under the charge of the fair Marie Antoine herself. I forget whether Monsieur the Fat Count of Provence took any share of this royal masquerading, but look at the names of the other six actors of the comedy, and it will be hard to find any person for whom fate had such dreadful visitations in store. Fancy the party, in the days of their prosperity, here gathered at Trianon, and seated under the tall poplars by the lake, discoursing familiarly together. Suppose of a sudden some conjuring Cagliostro of the time is introduced among them, and foretells to them the woes that are about to come. Ooh, Monsieur Lamonier, the descendant of a long line of princes, the passionate admirer of that fair queen who sits by your side, shall be the cause of her ruin and your own, asterisk, and shall die in disgrace and exile. You, son of the Khans, shall live long enough to see your royal race overthrown, and shall die by the hands of a hangman. Asterisk, 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 you, oldest son of Saint Louis, shall perish by the executioner's axe. That beautiful head, O Antoine, the same ruthless blade shall sever. He shall kill me first, says Lamballe, at the queen's side. S. Truly, replies the soothsayer, for fate prescribes ruin for your mistress and all who love her. Asterisk, 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 ND, cries Monsieur d'Artois, do I not love my sister too? I pray you not to omit me in your prophecies. Asterisk in the diamond necklace affair. Asterisk, asterisk, he was found hanging in his own bedroom. Asterisk, 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 among the many lovers that rumor gave to the queen, poor first who is the most remarkable. He seems to have entertained for her a high and perfectly pure devotion. He was the chief agent in the luckless escape to Varennes, was lurking in Paris during the time of her captivity, and was concerned in the many fruitless plots that were made for her rescue. First, who lived to be an old man, but died a dreadful and violent death. He was dragged from his carriage by the mob in Stockholm, and murdered by them. To whom Monsieur Cagliostro says, scornfully, you may look forward to 50 years of life, after most of these are laid in the grave. You shall be a king, but not die one, and shall leave the crown only, not the worthless head that shall wear it. Thrice shall you go into exile. You shall fly from the people, first, who would have no more of you and your race, and you shall return home over 500,000 of human corpses that have been made for the sake of you, and of a tyrant as great as the greatest of your family. Again driven away, your bitterest enemy shall bring you back. But the strong limbs of France are not to be chained by such a paltry yoke as you can put on her. You shall be a tyrant, but in will only, and shall have a scepter, but to see it robbed from your hand. And pray, sir conjurer, who shall be the robber? Ask Monsieur the Count d'Artois. This I cannot say, for here my dream ended. The fact is, I had fallen asleep on one of the stone benches in the Avenue de Paris, and at this instant was awakened by a whirling of carriages, and a great clattering of National Guards, lancers and outriders, in red. His Majesty Louis Philip was going to pay a visit to the palace, which contains several pictures of his own glorious actions, and which has been dedicated, by him, to all the glories of France. End of Project Gutenberg et Ex the Paris Sketchbook, by W.M. Thackeray. 70 PSB by Gutenberg Edition.